supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. You know, we're told by experts that hunger in America is on the rise. Well, look around you and take note. Here in Philadelphia, one out of every four people lives below the poverty line, and hunger is not choosy. It doesn't look at age or race. Of course, it's most tragic when we think about how it affects our children. For some, hunger is the choice between paying a utility bill or buying food. It's the burning feeling of helplessness experienced when there is food on the table, but not enough for you to eat, and nobody gets seconds. On today's show, we're going to be talking about hunger, how it hurts, more important, what we can do. I realize it's painful to listen to a show like this, that it's painful to try to fathom what it's like to have so little and to do without so much. It's hard. It's hard for all of us to make eye contact with this much suffering. In our first segment, Alfred Lubrano joins us. He's a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He's written a series of articles about hunger and poverty in the region. Welcome, Alfred.
Thank you.
Later on in the show, we're going to hear from Mariana Chilton, who's with Drexel University School of Public Health, Marion Campbell, who's the CEO and founder of Abundant Life Empowerment Missions, and we'll hear from Tiana Gaines, who participated in a project called Witness to Hunger. And if you want to join the conversation, our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. So, Alfred, let's talk about the impetus for your series. It was driven by the Food and Research Action Center survey. And what interested me about this, when I looked it up, was that 1,000 Americans are asked the same questions every night.
That's right, and they'll be asked those same questions every night for the next 25 years, according to Gallup Healthways, which is the originator of the poll.
So what questions do they ask about hunger?
There's just one question that they ask about hunger, but it very much mirrors the questions that are asked by the USDA when the USDA measures hunger, those numbers of which came out today, coincidentally. And the question is, in the last 12 months, have you had occasion to miss meals or not have enough money to buy enough food for your family? And that's even though it's the one question that they ask, it's considered by the USDA as a valid question and the most important question to ask when you're surveying about hunger.
What were the findings? What are the findings that came out today?
The findings that came out today showed I didn't see them all yet, but it showed that hunger pretty much stayed the same, unfortunately, between last year and this year, with things getting a little rougher for children under five, an extra 500,000 children experiencing hunger over the last year. Some of that is related to the recession, but a lot of it is just this continued grinding problem of poverty and hunger in this country.
You spoke specifically about Philadelphia's first congressional district being the second most hungry in the nation. 40% of that district are living with hunger. Where is this district, and why is there such grinding poverty there?
As you know, congressional districts are strangely drawn, and after the 2010 census is understood, it probably will be redrawn again. But essentially, the 1st Congressional District is everything east of Broad Street, sliding down through South Philadelphia, and then shooting over west to Chester. A few of the so-called river wards are not involved in, but essentially, it includes the poorest parts of Philadelphia, which are up in Kensington, in the Kensington area.
Why there? Why? There, and in Kensington, you cited, I forget what it was, some 60% living in poverty?
There's a little census block of people around Lehigh and Fifth where you will have 60% poverty, according to the 2000 census. Now, the newer figures will be coming out, and not too many people are very optimistic it's going to change very much. But that is there's a combination of things in that area. There are immigration problems. You have poor immigrants coming from the countryside in Puerto Rico. You have historically an area that lost 300,000 jobs between 1950 and 1980, and
that was a big industrial district, wasn't it?
It was, and it was a kind of a specialized industrial district. There was actually nothing quite like it in the United States. In its heyday in the early part of the 20th and late part of the 19th century, you had craftsmen making things that were quite specialized, lace, Stetson hats, certain kinds of shoes and gloves. These were smaller factories. When Sears came into being in the early 1920s, a lot of Americans moved away from these expensive, well-made items and got sort of the cheaper things. It was the Walmart of its day.
Right.
And as a result, these places were becoming obsolete almost overnight.
What's it like living there, Fifth and Lehigh?
I have to preface anything I say by saying that I'm an observer only, and I don't live there. And as a reporter, you're humbled by what you see and what people tell you. So the short answer is I don't know what it's like to live there, but what people will tell you that it's like, if they're aware of it themselves, because they're so used to this ground down kind of life. But it's a life where you have obsolete housing, bad schools, not enough food to eat, almost no jobs, constant danger, a thriving drug trade, and a growing sense that the rest of the city doesn't really care.
Are they right?
A lot of the people I talk to say they are.
Yeah. I befriended a young man from Camden who lived that way, and you know, he said his choices. He was 17 years old. He said his choices were to work at McDonald's or to sell drugs, and you know, his dad was in jail, and you know, and he had to help support the family, and he said those exact same words to me. Nobody cares. You know, people come in and they do something and then they go out. But he said, nobody cares. That was extraordinarily painful for me to hear.
Yeah, and to say nobody cares maybe is a bit of an exaggeration. There are many organizations, many social service organizations out there. But as one person said to me, you can have 300 people working for a single social service organization, but a kid will listen to the two guys on the corner selling drugs before they'll hear what the 300 have to say.
You know, you commented that you're a reporter and objective, but I wonder. You know, when we talked to you earlier, somebody said to you it felt like they walked into a brick wall every day, and you had commented then that the reporter in you was taken by that. By that language, that's writerly language, it's vivid. But what about the man, the human? What was it like for you? What is it like for you, so immersed in this suffering?
Well, that was Imani Sullivan who said that, and she has, sadly, a bird's eye view on what it's like to live that way. So when she talks about this wall, she knows whereof she speaks. For me, I think I said earlier that it's humbling. It is humbling. It is disconcerting. You're in a situation where you'll be interviewing somebody about absolute deprivation, and then go home and wonder what you're going to make dinner for your daughter. And as a situation I've been in, and sometimes it stops me. I absolutely have stopped at the stove and looked down at what I had, and it makes you there's a jumble of feelings that come over you. Like, what did I do to get this? I mean, there's no great difference between me and the people I write about. It's just, how is it that I have, you know, these beans, this pasta, and on and on.
Has it changed you?
I gotta hope so. I don't think I could have ever anticipated how I feel from this, but I'm learning something and feeling something new every day.
Painful.
Absolutely.
Yeah, pain's not always a bad thing. You also, when we spoke with you earlier, you said you've been writing about this for 2 years, and you said you're just starting to understand hunger.
Yeah. You have Mariana Chilton coming on in a little while, and she's a professor at Drexel School of Public Health, and she told me initially, she tried to explain to me what hunger is, and I think it took me a few months to understand what she meant, because so many of us walk around with this idea of those late night commercials for far off countries where children's bellies are bloated and there are flies in their eyes and that kind of thing. And I asked her, well, is that hunger? And she said, well, no, you're not quite getting it. And then more and more was almost like an ongoing tutorial with her. She tried to explain to me that there's a difference between starvation and hunger. And so when the federal government invented this term, food insecurity, at first it just sounded like gobbledygook to me because it didn't make sense. But now when you think about it, the idea that you don't have enough food for an active lifestyle, it's like, it's not starvation. And it's not like there's no food, but there's not enough food, there's not good food, and it's not going to propel people into thriving lives.
Yeah, and it kind of drives everything. I was thinking about this concept. Well, I've been thinking about it a great deal since I've been doing this research, and I think hunger anxiety is what drives a lot of us, whether we have food or not. It's anxiety about being hungry. Why many of us will finish one meal and begin thinking about what we're going to have next, and that's, we're afraid of being hungry. We can't tolerate it. It raises so many uncomfortable feelings, and here we're talking about a population that lives with that.
Right, and if you're a parent in the first congressional district, what you're thinking about a lot of the time is how much you're going to sacrifice of your own eating so that your children can eat. It kicks off a kind of anxiety and depression that a lot of us, whether we are a little anxious about what we're going to eat next, a lot of us don't even have a clue about how deep and how difficult that can be for people.
Your series really struck a chord in the larger community. Tell us what kind of feedback you're getting.
Well, people who... it's good that people are reading the newspaper, which is always a nice thing to hear these days. I was grateful for that. I personally got about 280 phone calls and 400 or 500 emails, which is a lot for us.
And considering the fact that they represent a small minority of the people who read the articles,
right,
care.
And I've been getting calls every day from October 10th when it first came out. People just, the good, well-meaning people just trying to figure out, what can I do? That's what they ask. What can I do? Can I do something? I cannot allow this to be.
What's the answer? I know we're going to do that for right after our break. We're going to get to lots of answers.
Yeah, you're better off talking to the academics for that. But from what I've gleaned and read, the answer is a complicated combination of massive federal effort and you know, local one-on-one kind of interaction, where at least the first step is people caring and understanding.
You know, we're going to have to say goodbye to you in just a minute. before our break, but just briefly, where to from here, Alfred? What's next?
In the series, in our stories? Yeah. We hope to have another 7 stories by the end of the year talking about various aspects of life in the 1st Congressional District. On Thanksgiving Day, we'll have a story about the only Latino Presbyterian minister in all of Philadelphia who left a rather cushy berth in Bryn Mawr to go up into Kensington and deal with a small bunch of folks that he's trying to shepherd through these very, very hard times.
Hmm. Wonderful. Alfred, I want to thank you for joining us. More important, I want to thank you as a citizen for doing the work you do, for shining a light on what's been in the darkness for way too long.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Thank you. That was Alfred Lubrano. He writes for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and he has written a series of articles about hunger and poverty in the region, and we just learned he will be continuing to write. After we take our break, we're going to hear from Mariana Chilton, who is with Drexel University School of Public Health. She heads the Philadelphia GROW Project and provides research for Children's Health Watch. Marion Campbell will join us. She's the CEO and founder of Abundant Life Empowerment Missions. And we're going to hear from Tiana Gaines, who participated in the Witness to Hunger Project, and she's going to help us put a human face on this issue. If you want to join the conversation, we'd love to hear from you. Our number is 888-477-9499. If you have lived with hunger or you live in fear of living with hunger, give us a call, 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Doctors at Penn's Depression Research Unit have been studying the causes and treatment of mood disorders since 1964 and are currently performing research to develop improved treatments. Symptoms may include mood swings, low energy, and low motivation. Initial evaluations are offered to determine those who are eligible for treatment. More about Penn's Depression Research Unit at 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
It's finally here. Newsworks.org. And every day it's growing. A virtual community focused on the real stories of the day, featuring some of the region's hottest bloggers and journalists. You can share your views and story ideas without fear of getting shouted down via the internet. It's Newsworks.org. For you, with you, by you. Check it out today and keep coming back to see what's new every day.
Welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about hunger in the city of Philadelphia, what it means, what it does, why it's happening, and more important, what we can do about it. My guests are Marion Campbell. She's CEO and founder of Abundant Life Empowerment Mission. She's a life coach who helps men and women look beyond their circumstances to see their potential. Marion, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I'm also joined by Mariana Chilton with Drexel University School of Public Health. Like I said earlier, she heads the Philadelphia GROW Project, provides research for Children's Health Watch, and she created the Witness to Hunger Project. We're going to hear more about that. It's a forum for sharing experiences of poverty and food insecurity. And I'm joined by Tiana Gaines. She participated in the Witness to Hunger Project. Tiana, welcome.
Thank you for having
me. So, Mariana, let's start with you. I want to understand the effects of hunger on children, but first I want to talk about their mothers, primarily mothers. What is the prenatal environment like for a fetus growing inside the womb of a mother who's hungry?
Well, it's not a good environment because the body is growing so fast and the brain is growing so fast in utero and right after the baby is born that any kind of nutritional deprivation has an enormous impact on the growth of the brain, which then translates into poor child development and also poor growth. So we've started to try to understand the experience of hunger in utero, but we primarily in our research, in Children's Health Watch research, we look at the effects on the child, the young child that's just been born and that's under the age of three.
Are women living with hunger able to breastfeed? Is the milk as nutritious?
Yes, they can produce milk. Yes, they can. You have to be very, very malnourished in order to lose your milk. But that does happen. I can't say it happens in the United States that we know of. But in circumstances such as in war or in severe, severe deprivation in the developing countries, there is an impact on breast milk. If a mother is not eating well, though, the micronutrients in her milk are not as good as they could be. So it's very important that a breastfeeding mother eats plenty and also has a very diverse diet, because then that also helps to program the child to search out healthy foods when they start to eat on their own.
Which, of course, doesn't happen when mother is hungry.
That's right.
Or stressed. It's interesting. The American Psychological Association just came out with their annual survey on stress. We're going to do a show about this in a couple of weeks. But one of the things they found is that the greatest stressor for our children is parental stress.
Mm, mm-hmm.
So when mom or dad are stressed, the children just absorb it through their pores. It's, you know, their survival depends on it. And kids try to compensate and so on and so forth. But
mm-hmm.
Here we're talking about, you know, stress with capital S here.
Right, absolutely. And in our research, we find that food insecurity is very much related to maternal depressive symptoms. And if a mother is depressed, not only does that affect the child's behavior, but the mom will also sometimes sort of disassociate herself from her child, will not interact with her child very much. So if the child is hungry, the child will also pull back and not interact with their environment because they're trying to conserve energy. In the same way, if a mom is depressed, she may not be able to reach out to her child as much as she should, and then that affects the child's brain growth and their development as well. So it's a constant interaction between nutritional deprivation and depression. All those things are coming into play with a young child.
And the majority of these children are living in single parent families.
Many of them are, but I wouldn't want to stress that too much. I think it's food insecurity can happen in all different kinds of households, but it is true that female headed households have the highest rates of hunger in the United States. It's a rate of about 40%.
You talked about a child's cognitive development, and we know that they're affected academically, so on and so forth. But I would imagine it also affects their ability to process information, take it in, do something with it, and bring it out. And I wonder if those scars can be compensated for later in life.
Well, that's still under debate, but there are many people who say that once a child is behind, the brain growth is happening so fast in those first 3 years of life, and then the brain doesn't grow as fast when a child turns 4 and 5. So really, by the time a child reaches kindergarten, if they're behind their peers, it takes a lot of effort and a lot of investment of money and time and attention to get that child back to developing to their full potential. But there really is a really important window of time in those first 3 years of life. And some say once that window is closed, it's very hard to get back in there and help that child to develop.
Yeah, others argue the opposite. They talk about brain plasticity. But, boy, you said three key words here that what's required to help these children's brains, and that's money, time, and I think it was attention. And those things are not available often in these families. I want to get to the psychology of this a bit. These children tend to be more isolated from their peers. What about siblings? Do we know?
I'm not a psychologist, so I really wouldn't want to. I wouldn't want to delve into that. I think probably you could discuss that as well. But I think it's not just the children being isolated. It's really the mothers who are very isolated. And that's when we were doing our research at St. Christopher's Hospital for Children. We found that we have researchers there 6 days a week, and we would talk to the women about their experiences with depression and learn about their food insecurity, not being able to pay for housing, not being able to pay for their utilities. It's enormously depressing. And the women would also talk about being isolated, not really having a good social network, that their own families had somehow ignored them, that they felt completely thrown away by society and really have no opportunities to participate in society and participate in their community. So I would say it's not just the children necessarily that are isolated. I think it's their moms and the families that feel very isolated.
Let me turn to you, Marion. Are they in fact isolated, these families?
I do believe that they feel that they are isolated because they do feel like they've been thrown away by society and nobody cares. But I think one of the things that I see with Witnesses to Hunger was a group of women who created their own network now. And to me, that was one of the positive things by some of the work that Mariana has been doing in the city of Philadelphia and really throughout the nation. And I think that we as individuals could do more to reach out. It's not just about writing out a check to an association, but really letting somebody know that you care and that they can do something. And I think that's one of the problems that I see.
Yeah, and that's much of what your work is about. How does one actually make a decision between paying the rent and paying for food?
I think I'm going to let, if you don't mind, I'll let Tiana answer that question.
Well, all right, then let me turn to you. Tiana, I want to know, then before we get to that question, tell us a bit about your life. How did you get involved in the Witness to Hunger Project?
I got involved with Witness to Hunger through St. Christopher's Hospital. I was there with my son. He was sick at the time, and a young lady came in, and she offered me to answer a few questions. And at first, I was very evasive about it, but she was very persistent, and that's how I got involved.
Why were you evasive?
Because living in certain situations, you become evasive, you put up a wall because you don't want people to know how you're living in the situations that you're living in because you're afraid it might get into the wrong hands. You know, someone might want to try to come take your children away, you know, and things like that.
So why did you tell her the truth?
I told her the truth because I was tired of being quiet about my situations. I wanted to know the right resources. I wanted to reach out and have a voice, and Witness to Hunger gave me that opportunity.
So it was really an act of courage to say your truth.
Very much an act of courage. Just leap out on faith and just, you know, stick my neck out there and hope to not get it chopped off, which I didn't.
Well, you know what? It's scary for everybody to look someone in the eye and say, please help me. That's an act of courage for any of us. I'm glad you did it. Tell us about your life back then. You were homeless twice. Tell us about how that happened.
The first time I was homeless is because I was living in a house that had lead paint, continuously falling, slumlord, not wanting to, you know, repair things in my household. So my son became getting very sick, having seizures very often, asthma and things like that. And me and his father decided that we wanted to move, not knowing, you know, stepping out, that we didn't have the right resources, we didn't have the right money, but we knew we had to do, you know, a very strong decision for our child. So we left and we couch surfed. We lived out of a hotel from time to time.
What do you mean couch surfed?
Couch surfing is when you live from one household to another with family members or friends.
Who were, family members and friends.
Yes.
You had enough of them, huh?
Some.
Where were the kids?
The kids were with me through the whole situation. My six-year-old has experienced homelessness twice. So, and he remembers very vividly where we were at and what we were going through.
So your friends and family took in you, and you had several kids, didn't you, when you were couch surfing?
Actually, I have six kids now through marriage, but I have three that I birthed myself, but I take care of six altogether. So at the time that I was homeless, the first time I just had my six-year-old, and then the second time I had all three of my children. And then at times when my other kids would come over for the weekend, you know, they would stay in the hotels with us as well.
How did you stay in hotels?
Basically, we had a little nest egg that we had saved away. You know, we were actually trying to save to get married at the time. And we used that money that we had saved to be able to live in a hotel with, you know, help of some family members and friends.
I'd like to go back, if I may, Tiana, a generation, and how all this happened in your life. Were you born into poverty?
I would say yes.
How so?
I was raised in a single family household. My mom worked two jobs, you know, struggled back and forth. I remember times coming up when My mom didn't have enough money, and she had to do the same thing that I'm facing to have to do now, as, you know, try to figure out whether do she pay the light bill or do she make sure she get me those new tennis shoes that I need. So, you know, it's really a vicious cycle.
Have you experienced hunger?
Oh, many of times.
Tell us about it. Tell us what it's like.
It's not a pleasant, it's not really pleasant. You know, me and a lot of my Witness to Hunger sisters, we experience hunger at an alarming rates, different times of the month, you know, all the time. We somewhat become immune to it. You know, we're used to it.
You're immune to your own hunger, but you're not immune to when your children experience hunger.
We try to keep our children away from that. We try to shield them from it as much as we can with using colorful words as it isn't enough or we don't have enough right now or mommy will try to get it.
What's it like for you?
It's very difficult. It's very difficult for me and my Witness sisters. It's very difficult to just look in your child's eyes over and over again and have to say those same words. You know, things will get better. And in the back of your mind, you're saying this, but you're looking at it in black and white. Nothing is really changing.
You also have to deal with harsh judgment of the larger society who looks down. And I see that kind of knowing nod on your face.
Yes.
How does that affect you?
It just makes me stronger in my fight, as well as my sisters. It makes us stronger to, you know, work with Miss Marion and Mr. Alford and Mariana to get our voices out there, because it is so easy for people to judge if they don't know. But I think a lot of times people try to put a smokescreen up because they don't want to really know. But now that the voices like Witness to Hunger and the Grow Project, we're just out there beating the pavements, and we're not letting people forget about that hunger is alive. And this is reality. We're not reading from any scripts. This is what we go through on an everyday basis.
How do you live today? What's your life like?
Right now, my life is I'm happy. You know, I struggle every day. I just currently got married to show my children that, you know, you have to have stability. And me and my husband, we live in a two-family household, and we still struggle.
How do you do it? How do you pay for it?
How do I pay for it? Well, I'm on public assistance. I do get help from the government, but that still isn't enough. You know, people think because you're on food stamps that you get enough every month, but they don't live in our houses.
How much do you get?
I get $600 and something in food stamps.
In food stamps.
Mm-hmm.
And how far does that go? You've got six children.
I have,
and
yeah.
Two adults.
Yes.
So how far does that go?
It doesn't go really far. You know, by the time of the end of the month comes, we run out of food. You know, sometimes we, you know, rely on some family members, friends, witnesses, Miss Marion, to bail us out sometimes. But it's very difficult, you know, but we make it.
And you've got other income, you've got a welfare check, a monthly welfare check?
I don't get cash assistance because I am married, and when you're married, you cannot receive cash assistance.
You made a choice to get married knowing you would lose cash assistance.
Yes. I made a very difficult choice to get married to show structure for me and my family. Me and my husband love each other very much, and we felt that we wanted to show our children that it's important to live, you know, being married. And it was we stepped out on faith, but, you know, we're kind of paying for it now, but we don't regret anything that we've done.
You don't?
No,
Your life is more difficult.
It's more difficult, but I wouldn't regret it.
Tell me about your husband.
My husband, we've been together for 11 years. My husband used to work for a moving company called Jensen Moving and Storage. He was laid off a year ago. He's a very strong, independent man. Very good father.
I've got to tell you, we've got to take a break, and then I want to talk to all three of you about what we can do about this. When our producer, Jennifer Lynn, spoke to you just briefly this weekend, you said to her, in the beginning of the month, when you have more money, you can't stock up on food because of rodents.
That's true.
In the house.
That's true.
That really struck me as what your house, what your life feels like.
Right. And people, you know, tend to say, well, you get $600 and something, why can't you go and, you know, stock up on cereal and things like that? Unfortunately, I can stock up on cereal, but by the morning time, there's some rodent or mice or something who's done ate through it. So that's why, you know, we know how to spend. We do know how to spend.
Well,
it's just not enough.
Let me offer you another voice. instead of the voice that's saying, why can't you make it work? Here's another voice, and I'm sure many of our listeners have this voice, and that is, what can I do? What can I do for you? Mm-hmm. What can be done? You have an answer?
Give back to your communities. Don't judge people by without knowing them. And really reach out. You know, lead our stories. Go on our blog and witness the hunger. And, you know, read the different stories of all the different mothers and just figure out what they can do within themselves.
Hmm. You were ashamed when you went to St. Chris, and you were ashamed to talk about your situation. You just talked about it now in front of a radio audience. How was it? How's it been?
I've been doing public speaking with Mariana and Miss Marianne's help, so it still makes me a little uneasy. I'm kind of twitching underneath the table here, but I feel honored to speak out because I'm speaking for the voices of many different families, some single women, some families with two households. You know, everyone is not single mother. You know, you do have some good guys who stick in there and marry and stay around. But even with two incomes, people are still struggling right in City Hall right now. With one income, you're still struggling. So imagine if you have no income, you're still struggling. And it's not that we don't want to work. You know, it's just right now with the economy and the way things are, you know, we're at the bottom of the bucket.
We're going to have to take a short break. When, like I said, when we come back, we're going to be talking about solutions. We've been listening to Tiana Gaines. She participated in Mariana Chilton's Witness to Hunger Project. You can learn much more about that project on our website, and you can learn much more about resources on our website, whyy.org/voices. When we come back, we're going to talk more about solutions. We'll hear from Mariana Chilton, who's with Drexel University School of Public Health, and she heads the Philadelphia GROW Project, provides research for Children's Health Watch. And we'll hear from Mariana Campbell. She's the CEO, founder of Abundant Life Empowerment Missions, and she's a life coach. And, of course, we'll hear more from Tiana Gaines. Well, if you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 888-477-9499. We will get to the phones after our break. That's 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM.
The Chester County Hospital supports WHYY and welcomes cardiac surgeon Dr. Brian Priest, new chair of their Cardiovascular Institute, affiliated with the Cleveland Clinic Heart Surgery Program. More at chestercountyhospital.org.
After a hard-fought election, Congress is back to work Monday, but knowing what they know about who won, who lost, and who's heading to Washington in January, will the old Congress be able to get anything done? Will the newcomers put their stamp on things before they even arrive? We'll talk about it next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
WHYY is supported by PNC Wealth Management, dedicated to helping customers achieve more by crafting personalized solutions to grow, preserve, and transfer their wealth. More information is available from Richard Cairns at 302-429-2058.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about hunger. We're putting a human face on it. We're talking about human lives, and we are going to be talking about what we can do. We're talking with Mariana Chilton, who's with Drexel University School of Public Health, and she created the Witness to Hunger Project. Tiana Gaines participated in that project, and she joins us here in the studio. And we're also joined by Marion Campbell, CEO and founder of Abundant Life Empowerment Missions, Inc. So let's start with you, Marion. We just heard Tiana's story. You know, when we think life coaches, we think, you know, middle class, upper class people, you know, who kind of want guidance about their life. So how do you work with mothers like Tiana?
So you're correct. Most of the time when we think about coaching, executive coaching,
right,
we think about people in a quote-unquote status and they're trying to get to the next level. But my mission was basically to empower the lives of those less fortunate. And in order to do so, I believe that, you know, coaching becomes a very critical component of it. And it's being able to sit down with somebody like Tiana and her husband, and talk about what do they want out of life, and help them to come up with their own personal vision of where they want to go, how they want to live.
For example, what that looks like.
So for an example, since Tiana's right here, we'll talk, if Tiana doesn't mind, we'll talk a little bit about Tiana. And so one of the things that, you know, out of our recent session, Tiana and I were talking about, what does she really want to do in her life? And, you know, she said, you know, Miss Marion, I really want to help other people. And so we talked about the potential of her going into social services, her looking at going back to school. I mean, Tiana is a high school graduate. Her husband has been laid off. But Tiana is starting to open up and say, you know what, I can do that, because somebody is encouraging her. Coaching is not about just telling somebody what to do. It's about encouraging somebody. It's about inspiring them that they can do a lot better than what they're doing. And don't worry about what other people think, because at this point, it's about you. It's about you and your life and what you want to do with your family and your children. So Tiana has began to think about going back to school, and I'm really pleased with that, because it shows that she can take the next step.
You know, Tiana, I listened to Marion describe what she provides, and it sounds like she's providing more than ideas and even more than support. There's a quality of this relationship here. Have you ever had a relationship with similar to the one you have with Marion? Someone who believed in you?
Of course, my mom, Miss Veronica Joyner, which is the founder of PUBS. But every relationship is different. My mom is my mom, so that's my mother. She's going to encourage me as a mother standpoint. Miss Marion and Miss Mariana encouraged me as far as my financial standpoint, how to make certain decisions, you know, how to go about it, you know, having the patience to tell my story and just be able to take in, you know, the knowledge from Miss Marion and Mrs. Mariana. Miss Marion encourages all.
Mariana, tell us about the Witness to Hunger Project.
I started Witnesses to Hunger out of frustration because I could not get the public to pay attention to food insecurity and hunger in the United States. I couldn't even convince my own neighbors that what I was working on child hunger, they did not believe that it actually existed, and they couldn't fathom it. They couldn't see it. I also take my research, my quantitative research, and I testify before Congress, and I try to explain to the senators and to the congressmen and women about the importance of food stamps and the importance of these other nutrition assistance programs, and talk about the magnitude of hunger, and I couldn't get any traction. Then I realized that perhaps I was a part of the problem. I'm called an expert witness on the Hill. The only expert witnesses on hunger and poverty are those who have experienced hunger and poverty. And in our research at St. Christopher's Hospital, you know, we met some extraordinary women, and I thought, you know, it's time for me to get out of the way, and let's get the moms to speak out on their own behalf, to speak directly to the senators, directly to Congress, directly to the press, to educate the public.
To what end? You know, you asked me before we started doing this show, what's my goal? Mm-hmm. Well, what's your goal of this work? Sure, you testified before Congress, and the goal there is clear, is to get funding for this, and, you know, in this political climate, it's less and less and less likely mm-hmm. that that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. Well, Alfred Lubrano said in the beginning of the show that it's going to require massive federal effort and a personal effort. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about that. You know, I asked Tiana, what can we do?
Well, there were a couple of questions in there. One of them is, to what end? I think the worst enemy of hunger in this country and around the world is indifference. And I realized that how do we break through indifference and judgment of others? And I felt like that working with the photographs, working with the women, they would be able to find a way to tell their stories that would crack the indifference shell. And I think that they've done that. And we've also tried to work on deepening the conversation about hunger and poverty. Most of the public thinks that, oh, well, in order to treat hunger, let's donate more cans of food to the local food bank.
And what's wrong with it?
That's a beautiful first step, but it doesn't end there. Because that is it's a Band-Aid on a gaping wound of hunger. So if you think about ways to get involved, what can a person do? Anywhere on the spectrum of poverty, people can volunteer and get more involved. People who can get involved with domestic violence, they can do more literacy training. They can read books with kids at the local library. They can volunteer more at their school to share their talents with other children. They can think about maybe working on housing issues, Habitat for Humanity. All of these components, utilities, housing, education, health, safety, there's lots of different portals to get involved in hunger. And really, the food banks are a tiny little piece of the solution. The other solution is getting more involved with your senators, your congressmen, the mayor, the governor. Start telling other people that you really care about hunger and that you don't want to tolerate it. Right now, we've been tolerating hunger in the United States. It's time for us to get more agitated, more upset, lose more sleep. Talk about solutions together. Get people who are wealthy talking to the poor. Cross race and class lines, cross gender lines to start discussing it and hold our leaders accountable for what can be done on a large scale.
You know, you talked about what can we do about this indifference. And as a psychologist, I want to say a lot of this indifference is not really indifference. It's not being able to face our own helplessness, our own anguish. I mean, I had mentioned I worked a full day on this show, and by the end of the day, when I had time to just reflect on what I was doing, I just cried. The pain was unbearable to me. And you know, that's easy to turn off and have the face of indifference. Marion, what can we do?
Okay, I just want to say something about what Mariana said about, or you said about putting food in the food banks. Well, it's nice, and I think that the programs out there have helped at some point, but what happens when you go to the food bank, but you have no place to cook the food at because you're homeless, because you're living out on the street? Mm-hmm. So when I look at the problem, and I agree, it's a kaleidoscope of a lot of things that go into the food insecurity, relates to homelessness, joblessness, and then hopelessness. I call it all the lessnesses that kind of combine itself to come into a situation. So when I look at it, I say, you know, even starting my own mission on this, is that I can't address just one piece of it. I have to address the educational component. I have to inform these clients.
How?
Well, I address the educational component when I meet with, and I call them my clients. When I meet with my clients, whether I'm meeting with the individual or whether I'm out in a homeless shelter doing an empowerment seminar that says to people that, you know what, you can move past this. But in order to move past that, you need to believe that you can get there. And what happens is that once you move them to that point, when they go to that job search and there's no jobs out here, then they're back calling saying, what do we do? I went here, I went there. You know, what am I supposed to do, Miss Marion? I'm really trying to move past my circumstances. So, you know, and so then we start calling and we're on Craigslist and we're looking all over just to try to find a person a job. So when people want to know how they can help, as Mariana said, by getting to your leadership, letting them know that homelessness is a problem. You can walk out on a Philadelphia street downtown at 8 o'clock at night and have somebody sleeping on a vent, and it shouldn't be that way. It should not be that way.
I want to do more as a, you know, I'm a listener here too. It's easy. I can write letters to my congressman. I'll write every day to my congressman. I'm not hopeful, but I'll do it. The question is more. I mean, you know, Tiana talked about eye contact. Mm-hmm. You know, you're literally and metaphorically making eye contact. I said in the introduction of the show that it's difficult to make eye contact with this kind of suffering. So what I'm hearing from maybe all three of you when I ask what to do is open the door and do something.
Yes.
I mean, call a school, something. Read in a kindergarten, do something. Tiana?
me and a couple of my witness sisters have came up with a certain thing we call the food stamp challenge. For all those who judge those on food stamps, who don't quite understand food stamps, I challenge you to live like we live. I challenge you to live off in one allotment once a month, a certain amount, and then you judge. Because you won't know not unless you walk through our shoes.
Yeah, that's a great source of your suffering, isn't it?
Yes.
Feeling judged and feeling isolated.
Yeah, man, because when you go in a common supermarket, people say, oh, well, they don't recognize a food stamp card. Everybody knows what a food stamp card looks like. You know, and yeah. Then people in line behind us, they judge, oh, well, look at her. She's in here with all her kids. She gets food stamps. I don't understand why she can't feed her kids. I don't understand why she's not eating along with her children.
How far do you have to go to get groceries?
I go about an hour and 45 minutes from my house to get adequate food.
Where do you go to? Where do you come
from? The shop, right? Up Aramingo Avenue. And I live at Frankfort and Margaret Orthodox. So literally, I have to either save or make a way once a month, sometimes twice a month, to pay someone to take me to the supermarket. That should not be. I should be able to walk to Frankfort Avenue and get an adequate apple. I should be able to get a nice piece of fruit at a reasonable price. I should not have to pay double because I live in poverty, and because of where I live, the convenience stores, they charge you double than what the supermarkets do.
Yeah, that's pretty painful. That's very painful. It's hard to listen to. Okay, so we've got a lot of great links on our website. Please check out our website, whyy.org/voices. If you want to do something, and God, I hope you do. Check out the website. There'll be lots of great guidance. Well, we are out of time. I want to thank all three of you so much for coming out, for sharing your life, Tiana, for doing the work you do. It's just wonderful and heartwarming. Mariana Chilton is with Drexel University School of Public Health. She started the Witness to Hunger program. Marian Campbell is a life coach who helps impoverished individuals, and Tiana, she's a mother of six, is one of many women who share their stories through the Witness to Hunger Project. Earlier on, we heard from Alfred Lubrano of the Philadelphia Inquirer. Next week on Voices, we're going to be rebroadcasting a show on gratitude, of all things. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Fred Snyder. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. Maggie Zahn and Stephanie Pena are our interns. And I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.